Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it's Katie Martone, Healthy Gut Girl. This is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I am coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine, and I have here with me today, so appropriate, is the king of gut health, Kiran Krishnan, microbiologist extraordinaire. I had some aha moments in this episode, and afterwards, and when I edited it, I had to sit there and really process and think about all the things that I learned today. And I think you're probably going to do the same. And I'll save my comments for after the show. I just want you to really listen, take notes, because I think he's got some pretty epic nuggets about how to crack into the mysteries of why some things are not healing in our bodies, that aren't even necessarily seemingly related to the gut, but very much have everything to do with the gut. All right, here he is, Kiran Krishnan.
Of course, I met you through Just Thrive and Beth and everybody. And I don't know if you knew, I had this estrogen dominance support group on Facebook for like 8 years.
Okay.
And I started it because I had my own issues with hormones, and I had been working on gut health, which is how I knew Beth and everyone, because I was doing the body ecology diet and teaching people how to ferment foods and all this gut stuff for years.
Okay.
And, but I had these like remaining hormonal issues. So I started the group, and I discovered Dr. Ray Peet's work and Katarina Dalton's work, and went down that rabbit hole and discovered bioidentical progesterone, and my life changed, and it was amazing. Yeah. So I've had 8 years under my belt of watching these anecdotal things happening in my group with women with progesterone. And one of the big, big things that we all grapple with is that when women start to supplement with bioidentical progesterone, we named it the estrogen kickback. If they're underdosing for their needs, their symptoms get worse, starting almost always with gut stuff, with like bloating, almost like period stuff starting to happen, where we think it's estrogen being stimulated. And this seems to be what the research shows. And so we usually say up your dose, you know, but sometimes that gets complex because women are up into the mega doses to get relief. And so we know something's being overlooked. So before I go any further, I just want to ask you what your take is on what is happening when women start to take bioidentical progesterone.
A key way in which estrogen is detoxed from the body is through the gut, right? So the constellation of microbes called estrobilome. And it's estrobilome's role to metabolize estrogen so less of it gets reabsorbed, and thereby maintaining the right balance of estrogen within the system. And if you are dysbiotic and you don't have enough microbes in the estrobilome, then you don't metabolize estrogen well, and higher amounts of it can get reabsorbed, thereby causing a dominance type effect. Mm-hmm. The evolution of that is that anytime the body dumps something into the gut, to as a way of getting rid of it, right? Which it does with a lot of compounds. In fact, almost anything that goes through phase one, phase two detox in the liver gets conjugated and dumped into the gut. The gut is kind of like the exit passage, right? Unless it becomes really small molecules, solubilizes, and then ends up in the kidneys for getting rid of it through urination, which even that the microbiome plays a role in doing. So the microbiome then develops the capability of metabolizing and essentially eating these hormones as a prebiotic almost, right? And so because it's feeding certain microbes. Now, if you start adjusting the amount of estrogen that's being dumped into the gut, that can skew the microbiota. And like any other prebiotic, if you all of a sudden take too much, you can get bloating, you can get distension, you can get, you know, GI-like symptoms. Because if it's stimulating the release of more estrogen, that could be one reason why you feel the GI symptoms, right? In some women, it may have the opposite effect, where your amount of estrogen dramatically reduces, and then that can also lead to GI symptoms, because that's like you take a certain amount of fiber every day, and then all of a sudden you stop. Right. And so you know you're going to have some GI disturbances, right? Because the microbes are now not getting what they expect to get in terms of their metabolic starting point. So to me, that would be the connection in there. I'd have to do the research a little bit to see what's been supported with that idea. But we know that estrogen is dumped into the gut for metabolization, and the metabolic byproducts have these other effects. But that's a key way in which we detox from estrogen, or women detox from estrogen predominantly. And so microbes, certain types of microbes, look at estrogen as food, right? And no different than another microbe would look at a prebiotic, an oligosaccharide, as food. Mm-hmm. And so anytime you adjust the food amount that's going in, you can get these kind of GI symptoms.
Wow. So let me see if I caught that properly. So when a woman starts to alter her hormone levels, in this case, supplementing bioidentical progesterone, and there is this potential stimulating of the estrogen receptors, let's say, and the body starts to balance, because we know that that's what progesterone does, is it helps regulate or oppose estrogen. So maybe it starts to detoxify some of that excess estrogen, dumps it into the bowel, which feeds the estrobilome, which then has a byproduct, because those microbes have a waste product, right? When they eat their fiber, and that byproduct can be gaseous, it can be, you know, appear or manifest as bloating, different kinds of bowel movements, maybe slow motility or even diarrhea. So did I get that right?
Yeah, essentially. And I think one nuance to that is estrobilome is like a constellation of microbes, right? There's lots of different kinds of microbes in that mix that they call estrobilome. There are some microbes within that mix that will metabolize estrogen to create more noxious byproducts, and others will create more beneficial byproducts, right? No different than fiber. You have lots of microbes in your gut that can digest fiber. Some will convert them into short chain fatty acids, which are great for you. Some will convert them into ammonia and gas and so on, which is not great for you, right? So that's the same thing. So then if the woman is already hormone imbalance, hence she's taking supplemental progesterone, she likely has a dysfunctional estrobilome to begin with, right? And that may be a driver of why she's imbalanced to begin with, because the cycle of detox through the gut is not the way it should be, right? Mm-hmm. So basically then the change in progesterone is further exacerbating that dysfunction in the gut.
Wow.
Because if we do the bioidentical progesterone, without paying full attention to the gut and the detox system in the gut, right, then we are correcting the hormone balance, or we're pushing the correction up here, but then down here where the hormones are recycled and metabolized and all that, that's still dysfunctional, right? So I think that's where the imbalance will occur.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, it's not cool, but it's interesting because it kind of also probably speaks to insulin resistance, because mm-hmm. when women start progesterone, bioidentical progesterone, all these things happen that are awesome. They're like, wow, you know, I'm not bleeding as much. I'm mm-hmm. sleeping through the night, yada, yada. But I've gained 10 pounds in 2 weeks,
right?
Or, you know, and I'm not pooping, or I'm having these issues at the gut. So, can you tell, so that there's some kind of axis there that's being disrupted. So the progesterone is great, but what's happening with insulin resistance in that case?
And so we know that insulin resistance is largely driven by dysfunction in the gut, right? So when you add that on, then what it's saying, you know, that analogy I gave, that the progesterone is balancing the issue up here, but down here where things have to get recycled, detoxified, and moved, all the gut components of it are clearly not being addressed, right? Mm. Which means, and maybe even being exasperated in a way, which means that analogy is absolutely true, that in circulation, when you take the bioidentical, and I imagine most of the bioidentical is either through a pellet or a cream or something like that, right?
Yeah, topically usually.
Yeah, topically. So it's going into the circulation. So you're trying to fix and balance things at the circulatory level. But as it comes onto the gut, when the gut plays that critical axis of metabolization of these things, it's clearly driving more dysfunction. And the number one driver of insulin resistance is dysbiosis in the gut, right? So even American Diabetic Association has published that leakiness in the gut, endotoxemia and dysbiosis in the gut, and lowering of keystone species like Acromantia, Bifidobacteria, and all that, those are the things that set up the inflammatory process that leads to insulin resistance. Mm. And then, of course, that cause you to put on weight. When you put on weight, not only are you insulin resistant, you're leptin resistant, right? So the leptin resistance, which is also a gut function, primarily, both of those things are centered around further gut dysbiosis. So if those are the common symptoms, and I'll say what one is doing is you're band-aiding a situation up here, but you're causing a bigger problem down here, right? Mm. Because you're likely causing leaky gut. And if you're causing leaky gut, which goes along with insulin resistance, leptin resistance, metabolic disorders, you know, bloating, gas, digestive discomfort, chronic constipation, SIBO eventually, the IBS-like symptoms, and then it just keeps going, right? Mm-hmm. Those are in a long-term perspective, very, very serious and problematic issues, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that has to be focused on and addressed to some degree.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a problem with that's the allopathic approach, right? That is, it's like, okay, this is imbalanced here. We're going to intervene with this one compound, but it's not looking at the whole system, mm-hmm. right? Like what happens that to the balance that we're trying to bring here? How does that affect the detox pathways and all that down here, right?
Right.
How does that impact the microbes? But when you don't have a holistic approach, you don't look at all those things.
And so, yeah. It's such a little spider's nest because so many women are suffering so much. And, mm-hmm. you know, when they get relief from pretty severe debilitating things, you know, like insomnia and, you know, bleeding out for 20 days out of the month, it's hard to trade that off. And a lot of these women in the group have been with me forever and, you know, for the 8 years and we've all been working on our guts. And so it's like, what am I missing? You know, so it's very hard to give up the thing that is helping in many ways.
Right.
And you know, you said the insulin resistance is a gut thing. We're always talking about cortisol and, mm-hmm. you know, we're running off our adrenaline, off our emergency hormones, like we forego the thyroid, liver, energy, ATP production, because we're in this fight or flight and we're using our emergency backup hormones. Mm-hmm. And then that's oftentimes the link I feel like with insulin resistance, it almost triggers it because, you know, people have bad guts their whole lives and they don't, their whole young lives, and they don't have insulin resistance until they get into their hormonal, you know, where perimenopause, menopause, and then it really, really shows itself. And so, you know, it's like, what's going on that the gut is able to manage that for all these young years? And on all of a sudden the hormonal component comes in where they run out of progesterone and estrogen dominates. And now you've got this cortisol, thyroid, it's just a rat's nest. So let's all go back to the gut always, right? Always go back to the gut.
Yeah. Now, it also doesn't mean you can't do or you shouldn't do progesterone replacement, right? And gain that relief. But at the same time, it means that it sounds like there has to be some very specific focus on the gut, especially with regards to certain types of dysbiosis, right?
Yeah.
Because the insulin resistance component of it, the metabolic dysfunction, those things are very specific types of dysbiosis. So 9 out of 10 times, if you start developing metabolic dysfunction where you're gaining weight, you're getting insulin resistant, you're likely getting leptin resistance, it means that you've increased intestinal permeability, you've lowered acromantia, you've lowered short chain fatty acid production. Just bringing butyrate down alone can set you up for insulin resistance, right?
Mm.
The drug metformin, which is a drug that is widely used for people who are pre-diabetic and who are at risk of diabetes, it's a wonder drug in many ways in diabetes because for a long period of time, it really keeps people in insulin balance. And the way it does it is it increases butyrate production in the gut, mm. right? So it's just a simple act of reducing short chain fatty acids that can throw off the whole system, right? So speaking of it from the perspective of cortisol, so cortisol, what cortisol tends to do is cortisol also gets dumped in the gut as part of its cycle, right? So when you experience fight or flight and cortisol levels are going up, right, as you're going through the peaks of your flight or fight or your stress response, and then cortisol, as it goes up, starts dumping part of it in the gut. And the reason it dumps in the gut is because there are microbes in the gut that metabolize cortisol, and the metabolic byproducts of that go to your kidneys, and it forces your kidneys to dump a bunch of sodium and potassium into circulation to increase blood pressure, right? And the whole idea behind that is to get your body ready for flight or fight. You're trying to get more perfusion of blood to your heart and to your brain and to your muscles, right? Your body's, when cortisol is going up, it's in fight or flight response, right? It's trying to survive. So that's why chronic stress can lead to chronic hypertension, right? That's, it comes through that mechanism. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing that happens with cortisol as it's dumping into your gut is it starts to bind glucocorticoid receptors. And then when it binds enough of the glucocorticoid receptors, all of those send a negative feedback signal to turn off the stress response, right? So that's how the negative feedback part of the stress response works to turn it off. So you're, that way you can go through a stress response and cortisol goes up, it starts getting metabolized and binding all the glucocorticoid receptors. And then the circulatory level of cortisol goes down. And then the parasympathetic kicks up into the sympathetic pathway, right? Mm. So that's the curve you're supposed to go through. Here's the problem with a dysbiotic gut, is that over time, as your gut becomes more and more dysbiotic, and that's a factor of age and exposure to things that aren't great for your gut and so on, or even, you know, too much estrogen being dumped into the gut over time can drive a dysbiosis. The dysbiotic gut, when cortisol dumps in, it creates an immediate intestinal permeability. So it creates a huge influx of IL-6 and interferon gamma and TNF-alpha. So you get this huge inflammatory spike when cortisol dumps into the gut. The problem with that is that IL-6, when it goes up, it can go back to the brain and reactivate the HPA axis, thereby starting the cortisol cycle all over again, right? Mm-hmm. And then that cortisol dumps into the gut, makes it even more leaky, more IL-6 goes up, reactivates the HPA axis again. So what tends to happen is people tend to stay in this basal state of anxiousness throughout the day because you're constantly in the sympathetic flight or fight phase, right? And mm-hmm. It's not a lot of external stimuli causing it or anything. You're just kind of in this agitated state. And it could have been because of one thing in the morning, right? One thing in the morning sets you off, puts you in that state, and then it's very hard to come off of it, mm-hmm. right? Because your gut is a checkpoint to turn that off. And now if your gut is dysfunctional, and we know it's dysfunctional enough to drive you towards insulin resistance already and metabolic dysfunction, now the leakiness from the stress causes more insulin resistance, more metabolic distress, less production of short chain fatty acids, and so on. This is how when you're stressed, you can put on weight. I mean, part of it is when you're stressed, you eat more, right? Some people eat more, not everybody, but some people eat more because that's a dopaminergic cycle. You're trying to stimulate dopamine, so you're eating. Other people will get, you know, attached to other things like drinking or recreational drugs. Mm-hmm. That's a self-medicating example. But what does happen when you're elevated in cortisol and stress, especially if your gut is dysfunctional, is it causes severe leakiness in the gut. That severe leakiness in the gut causes insulin resistance and metabolic distress, right? And over time, it just becomes harder and harder to come off that cortisol cycle and that sympathetic activation. And you're right, you know, people are running on adrenaline because what's happening to release cortisol is you're activating the HPA axis, right? Your hypothalamus is activating your pituitary is activating your adrenals are firing, and you're trying to work in that situation. But at some point, your adrenals are going to go into fatigue, right? And then it's just going to be a shutdown of the system.
Wow. You know, it's tough again with because, you know, you mentioned leaky gut. Once leaky gut happens, I mean, isn't that in itself fight or flight? Like once you actually have that permeability and now, you know, it's almost like a low grade infection in a way, isn't it? It's almost like having Lyme disease or, you know, maybe nothing happened in the morning. Maybe you just have low grade infections, multiple of them. And so you're always in this state of fight or flight. And so it's really hard to kind of like get in front of that problem, because doesn't your adipose tissue start to become a cortisol and estrogen machine as well? I mean, don't they start producing it also?
It can. Yeah, absolutely. Because adipose tissue is a endocrine organ. But, you know, everybody naturally wakes up with an elevated level of cortisol, right? That's normal. That's part of our waking up process. It's really about getting you up and ready. And just think about from an evolutionary standpoint, right? You're most vulnerable when you're sleeping. Right. So here you are sleeping in your hut or your cave, right? That's when you're the most vulnerable. And your body is designed to, when you awaken from that sleep, to be ready to defend yourself, fight, run away, whatever it may be. Right. So we're programmed to have an elevated level of cortisol when we wake up. So nowadays, when we wake up and we have that elevated level of cortisol, if our gut is dysfunctional, that cortisol is making your gut leaky and then reactivating the HPA axis throughout the day. So yes, you can absolutely wake up without anything happening that morning and be in this basal anxious state, right? And stay in that basal anxious state. And then the problem with that is your tolerance level for any other stimulus is much lower, right? When you're in that agitated state already, anything else that shows up as a external stressor, whether it's somebody cuts you off as you're driving to work in the morning, or you're running late, or just something that's relatively benign, but it still agitates you at a higher level because you can't, you can't really deal with it, right? Because the other part, so in your brain, there's an area of your brain called a coping center. And when you're in this agitated flight or fight response, your brain doesn't have the coping centers on very effectively. And part of the reason is it's evolutionarily a protection, because what your brain doesn't want you to do is when you're in actual danger to sit and analyze things, right? It wants you to react. If you're walking through, you know, the African plains when we were hunter gatherers, foragers, and so on, and you hear a rustling in the grass, your brain doesn't want you to look there and go investigate and see what's actually creating the rustling. You'll probably get eaten, right? So your brain wants you to go rustling. I'm running out, you know, and you run. It's a reaction. It's not a rationalization. So your coping centers are low, which means that almost any negative stimuli or external stressor that comes in, you can't rationalize, you can't deal with it, right? So it elevates the whole system more. And at the end of the day, the important point with all of this is that if you have a really healthy gut and you know how to focus on it in a certain specific way, and we'll talk about exactly what you need to combat the metabolic dysfunction. We'll talk about what you need exactly to combat the effect that cortisol and stress has on the gut negatively. If you have a really healthy gut and you have the right components in your gut, there are certain microbes in the gut that produce a compound called peptidoglycan. Peptidoglycan has been designed by nature to be the shunt to the effects of cortisol on the gut. It's the key thing that allows you to have a stress response, but come down from it and go back to a normal state, right? We've outsourced that capability to this bacterial byproduct called peptidoglycan. And peptidoglycan, as it turns out, has been important to us since we were in utero, since our brains were developing. So the placenta has receptors and transporters for mom's peptidoglycan, bacterial peptidoglycan. So it'll grab peptidoglycan from circulation, and I'll explain how the peptidoglycan gets into circulation. That's a fascinating part of it. And then it carries the peptidoglycan, and mind you, this is a bacterial byproduct, carries it to the baby's brain, where the baby's brain has receptors for it. And that induces the development of the brain. It induces the cellular differentiation, the myelination of the central nervous system, the development of the blood-brain barrier. All of these really important things that we want to happen to the baby's brains are induced in part by a bacterial byproduct. Wow. Right. So from day one, peptidoglycan has been important for your brain and central nervous system. So for the rest of your life, once your brain is done developing, the same peptidoglycan is the thing that shuts off the leaky gut that cortisol creates. And it shuts off the inflammatory response. So you don't get the big IL-6 spike. You don't get the big interferon spike. You don't reactivate the HPA axis. Right. And one of the critical things that happens after numerous cycles of this type of cortisol activation and reactivation is tryptophan, which is a really important amino acid, right? Is the precursor for melatonin and serotonin, right? So melatonin and serotonin are made from tryptophan in the central nervous system. What tends to happen after numerous cycles like this over a few year period, or it could be after 6 months, is your tryptophan metabolism gets tripped towards forming kynurenine and quinolinic acid, which are neurotoxic, right? So now, not only can you not come down from the stressors that you experience, you're constantly in fight or flight response, you're constantly in sympathetic response. Because you're in sympathetic, you can't really digest because digestion occurs in the parasympathetic. So you're not bringing in or assimilating nutrients properly. Your metabolic health is getting compromised. Your glucose control and insulin resistance is going up. And then at the same time, your tryptophan is not being converted into melatonin and serotonin. So it becomes harder to fall asleep and becomes harder to feel happy because serotonin is a happy hormone. Melatonin is a sleep hormone, right? You're not making those at the same level that you're supposed to be making. All of that because your gut was dysfunctional in the first place. So I would almost argue 8 out of 10 cases before a woman becomes severely hormonal imbalance, right? To the point where she needs progesterone cream and replacement to help balance the symptomology and all that, her gut was likely going under a significant amount of distress already, right? So some of these underlying symptoms may have already been there. And then the continued hormone dysfunction creates even more severe symptomology. And then you may correct the hormone imbalance in the circulatory level through the creams, but it still leaves the gut portion completely open and maybe gets worse, right?
Wow. That was a journey. Say it again, peptidoglycan?
Peptidoglycan, yeah. It's a type of carbohydrate. It's so we launched a product at the end of last year called Zen Biome. And Just Thrive, it's called Just Calm. It is a psychobiotic strain. It's called Bifido Longum 1714. And it's a strain that has a lot of peptidoglycan on it. It produces all this peptidoglycan. In an electron micrograph, it basically looks like, you know, thousands of little arms or tentacles hanging off the bacteria, right? So what tends to happen with this bacteria is when it's ingested, or let's say you have a natural high level of it, which we haven't seen in most Americans to have a good healthy level of this kind of bacteria, what happens is at the terminal end of your ileum, there's this immune tissue called the Peyer's patches. And the Peyer's patches, the dendritic cells and the macrophages that line your gut, the immune cells, they're constantly going out and sampling microbes that live on the luminal side of your intestine. So they'll grab and they'll consume the microbes, and then they'll present the antigens to the immune system. So your immune system has a constant catalog of which kind of microbes exist in your gut or are coming through. What's so interesting, the way this works, is that the dendritic cells will see this peptidoglycan, covered bacteria will ingest it. And then instead of presenting the antigens like it normally does, it'll digest the bacteria on the inside and spit out all of the peptidoglycan into your circulation. And that's, in fact, how the baby gets it. Mom's dendritic cells will go across her gut, grab bacteria that have peptidoglycan, and bring it through cord blood into the baby and deliver this microbe to the baby. But it doesn't deliver the whole microbe. It digests the microbe on the inside of the cell, on the inside of the dendritic cell, and it spits out just the peptidoglycan, because that's the most important part. So what we found, we started working on this a while ago. What we found is when we were screening elderly Irish women, because this was being done at a research institute called the APC in Cork, Ireland. They were screening lots of, women over the age of 60 plus who were Irish, of Irish descent. They were looking for women who had long history of very strong mood stability, hormone balance, didn't have any severe symptomology, slept really well. And they were comparing their gut microbiomes to women of the same age that had really poor outcomes with all of those. And they found that the women who were very well balanced had high levels of this peptidoglycan microbe. So we isolated it, studied it, developed it, and then I think we've published 7 studies on it now.
Wow. And so where would we normally acquire that microbe from? You said it's a carbohydrate?
The microbe has a carbohydrate coating around it.
Okay.
So normally you should be getting it from your mom, right? During the birthing process.
Oh.
If your mom was in a distressed state, didn't have adequate amounts of it, you probably didn't get enough of it, right? Because bifidobacteria is a very important microbe. It's one of the early microbes that inhabits the baby's gut. Mm-hmm. And most of the bifidobacteria you get from mom, because bifidobacteria is a predominant microbe in the stool, right? Because it lives in the very end of the large intestine. And so you get higher amounts of it coming out in the stool if you're a healthy individual. And during the birthing process, a normal birthing process, there's always some level of defecation that occurs and the baby gets exposed to mom's fecal matter, right? Along with everything else. And so that's how the bifidobacteria gets into the gut of the baby. Now, some of the facultative bacteria that the baby picks up through the vaginal canal and so on will start eating away at oxygen in the baby's gut, because the baby's gut will have oxygen to a certain degree. And the moment the oxygen is gone, then the bifidobacteria, which tends to be anaerobic or prefers to be anaerobic, will settle in and start taking over the microbiome. Hmm. In the first 6 to 8 months, the baby's gut is predominantly bifidobacterium if it's a healthy baby. And a healthy baby also will tend to have a lot of this peptidoglycan type of bifidobacteria, right? But in the U.S., there's a few different issues, right? In North America, number one is 30%+ of all births are C-section, right? So you're not getting that exposure. Even mm-hmm. if mom had adequate levels, you're not getting the exposure because babies are being pulled right out of the stomach or right out of the womb, sorry. And then number two is a lot of people have very low levels of these important keystone species. So we're not passing them on enough, wow. right? That's why each generation has a harder and harder time dealing with stress. We hear all these people saying anecdotally, like, well, when I was a kid, you know, that stuff didn't bother us. And, you know, we didn't have anxiety and but then we think of, oh, the world today is different and all that. A lot of it is that our brains are different. We can't deal with things the same way because we're not passing down these really important protective strains that protect our brain and the inflammation and HPA activation and all that.
Interesting. So it's just not something you can just go out and like ferment some veggies and try to get more of. It's just something that's handed down, almost like kefir grains, you know, like from the generations ago where people have like, you know, 20 generations of like the same kefir grains. That's a bummer.
Yeah, well, you have the beauty of it. You can supplement with it now, right?
You can
get back into your system because of the microbiome research that goes on. So that's a good thing, you know, that there's a lot of companies and people that are focusing on this kind of stuff and identifying the right microbes and making it available again to people to be able to add it back into their system. Because without it, that deals with the root cause of stress response and gut-brain interaction and so on. And if you don't address that, then we're going off into the SSRIs and the anti-anxiety meds and, you know, all of those
things.
And then you go down that rabbit hole and it becomes another mess.
Right. Well, you brought up SSRIs, which made me think of your serotonin comment being the happy hormone. Did you read this study about this this bombshell serotonin high in depression, not a happy chemical, lowers energy, depression, self resolves? If you haven't seen that, I'll send it to you. It's kind of shocking, but it really makes a lot of sense to me in regards to having this group and seeing all these women who many of them are on SSRIs and having a really difficult time managing their depression, because it seems like the industry just wants to work on that happy hormone, that happy brain chemical. And do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. And in fact, you know, what's interesting about that discovery was that this has been well known with as a side effect of SSRIs, right? So one of the first side effects of an SSRI when you start it is that you can actually get much more depressed in the first few weeks, right? It creates almost panic-like depression for people. And that's because of the unusual amount of serotonin that's building in their synaptic regions, right? Because SSRIs block the reuptake pumps of serotonin. So that's an artificial way of building the concentration of serotonin in the synaptic regions of the neurons, right? And again, that is that the single pathway focused allopathic approach is that, okay, if people who are depressed tend to have, you know, poor balance of serotonin, let's block the reuptake pumps and accumulate more serotonin. That should be good for them. Well, the problem with that is we're not considering the whole balance of the system, right? Because serotonin and dopamine have to work well together. So if you're increasing serotonin, what's happening with dopamine and dopamine levels, right? We also know that things like reuptake pumps are really important as part of the negative feedback loop to be able to make more things, right? So the body, when it comes to neurotransmitters and hormones and all that, have a lot of what we call negative feedback loops, right? To tell the body how much of everything to make. So the reuptake pumps are all blocked up. They're not pulling up serotonin. Then you could actually have a situation where your body doesn't know how much serotonin you actually have or are making and may kick up the serotonin production more and more and more, right? Mm-hmm. Then you can have toxic levels of it, very, very high toxic levels of it, which is really unusual, right? It's like a good, too much of any good thing is really bad for you, right? You could have too much water and die, right? Hyponatremia is a condition of drinking too much water and dying from that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's not surprising that when we interfere with, in that severe kind of fashion with the balance of these things like neurotransmitters and hormones, we're going to cause a problem in a different component of the body, mm-hmm. because all of these are designed to have really keen balance in the system, right? That's how nature functions.
Hmm. When let's talk about SIBO. Mm-hmm. It's probably the most common problem in the group is women that have SIBO. And I actually have a bunch of questions, not a bunch, but some questions. And that was a lot of them were saying, what do we do about SIBO? Sharon says he knows this terrible condition, how to finally get on the other side of it. And then there are so many others regarding SIBO. So what would you have to say about SIBO? And what is estrogen's role in SIBO?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mentioned SIBO when I was going through my little monologue there of experience of explaining how everything goes wrong, right? Because that's a factor that occurs no matter what. Mm-hmm. So hormones to some degree play a role in SIBO, to some degree, but it's not necessarily the hormones themselves. It's more so the underlying gut dysfunction that already existed that may be persisted because of not focusing on it enough, right? So estrogen, for example, like I mentioned, if you start having varying concentrations of estrogen dumping into the gut, it can by itself cause dysbiosis in the gut. And anytime you cause dysbiosis in the gut, you have a risk of developing SIBO. Now, and then another aspect of it is your liver and your liver health, right? So most of the hormone detoxing or removal in the body goes through the liver as well, right? Mm-hmm. So if you imagine, you know, you're taking, for example, progesterone creams or things like that, that eventually those things will have to end up going through the liver at some point. And your estrogen phase one detox goes through the liver as well. So everything goes through the liver. If the liver starts to become compromised and it's dealing with too much, it has to detoxify too much. And as you age, your liver doesn't function as well as it used to. What basically starts to happen is the bile acid pool that your liver produces reduces, right? So the liver is responsible for producing bile. And the bile acid pool starts to shrink as the liver becomes more and more compromised or has to undergo heavier workload. So now when your bile acid pool shrinks, that means every time you eat, the amount of bile your gallbladder is releasing into the small intestine reduces over time. And bile is a very, very critical component of preventing SIBO from happening. Because bile by itself is an antimicrobial. So it brings down the microbial growth in your small intestine when there's food present, right? Because when there's food present, that's a time for the bacteria to go crazy and they start metabolizing and creating this overgrowth, right? But bile prevents all of that from happening because it's a strong antimicrobial. It disinfects and it kind of keeps microbial growth low, right? Because it lots of bacteria find it really hard to function under, when they're covered in bile. So that's one function of bile. The other function of bile is as it gets recycled. So keep in mind that for every meal that you have, you can have about 15 times the bile acid pool cycling through the digestion process of that meal. right? Which means the same bile acid pool is being secreted out the gallbladder. It runs through the small intestine. It gets reabsorbed at the terminal end of the small intestine near the ileum, and then goes back to the liver. It drops off the fat-soluble nutrients, the fat-soluble toxins, everything it picked up during the moving through the small intestine. And then it gets cleaned up and sent back to the gallbladder to be released again, right? So that happens upwards of 15 times in a given meal.
Wow.
As bile is being reabsorbed in the small intestine, it triggers a receptor called the nuclear FX receptor. The nuclear FX receptor causes your small intestinal lining cells to release antimicrobials during the process of digestion. So you have a higher amount of antimicrobials, your own natural antimicrobials, that are released into the luminal side of the small intestine to prevent microbes from overgrowing, right? So not only do you have bile preventing that directly, but bile also triggers the release of antimicrobials to further prevent overgrowth of microbes in the small intestine. Now, if bile starts becoming compromised, if your liver is undergoing high amounts of stress and it's producing less and less and less bile, then you don't have those protections. You have a much higher risk of microbes overgrowing, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one key reason why you have a risk of SIBO if you're in this state of hormone imbalance and you're taking lots of things and so on. Your liver over time can become more and more compromised. And the hormone imbalance to begin with, before you even started intervening, can start driving your liver into a high degree of stress. We know that, for example, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease or any sort of liver dysfunction dramatically, almost four times higher, increases your risk for SIBO because of the bile storing. The second part of it is what happens with your stomach, right? If you reduce stomach acid production, whether it's through using PPIs, so a lot of times what happens is people get bloating, distension, discomfort, right? And so that may lead to reflux. And then you reach for the PPIs, right? You reach for the proton pump inhibitors because you're trying to reduce the reflux. Mm-hmm. And the PPIs allow for microbes in your mouth, which are particularly gram-negative bacteria, to survive through the gastric system and inoculate your small bowel in a very significant way. You're literally swallowing billions of bacteria every single day. You have Enterococcus faecalis, Enterococcus faecium, E. coli, all of that in your mouth. You're swallowing all that constantly every single day, and it's not being killed in the stomach because you've increased the pH in your stomach by taking PPIs, right? Or antacids and things like that to try to deal with the discomfort you have in your stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And so now when those gram-negative bacteria start to inoculate your small bowel, those are the most prolific SIBO bacteria because mm-hmm. not only can they colonize and they can easily compete with the natural bacteria that's there, they also tend to be bile resilient. So bile doesn't even control their growth very well.
Wow.
Right? So over time, it gets higher and higher and higher. There is a condition called PPI-induced SIBO, which is SIBO that develops because of the use of proton pump inhibitors, and by that extension, antacids as well. And then there's one more thing, H. pylori growth, right? Helicobacter pylori, I would venture to guess at least 50% of the women in the group and people that are dealing with the symptoms that you're describing have overgrowth of H. pylori in their system, right? H. pylori is another thing that buffers stomach acid and brings up the pH in the stomach. So it easily leads to SIBO, but H. pylori is even more egregious because it's creating inflammation in the lining of the stomach, which then creates inflammation throughout the body, which can lead to autoimmune diseases, which can lead to food sensitivities, severe allergies, and all that. So it all starts to spiral again, right? Mm-hmm. And I think at the end of the day, the biggest problem I see with hormone imbalance and the therapeutics around that is, yes, we're going after the imbalance and we're going directly with it, whether it's testosterone replacement, progesterone replacement, you know, even estrogen replacement under the right conditions, that is a one-to-one function, right? We have to still look at the underlying problem. And most of the women in your group probably had the underlying gut function to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And it all has just gotten exasperated as they go along, you know, and it does as you get older.
Yeah. Just to clarify, so H. pylori is native to the lining of our stomachs, but it is the overgrowth and the lack of the stomach acid that lets it overgrow, then that's when it becomes an infection. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, and there's a little bit of controversy over this, right? Is it really native? Is it not? The statistics show that at least 50% of the adult population globally have an overgrowth of H. pylori, right? And typically that is defined as if you do a stomach aspirate test, right? That means you send in a tube and you pull liquid from the stomach, and then you check the liquid from the stomach. If you are above what we call 10 to the 5 CFUs of H. pylori per ml of stomach aspirate, then you have infectious levels of it. If you're below 10 to the 5, then it's considered non-infectious levels, right? Now, above the 10 to the 5, it's clearly a problem. That means H. pylori are doing clear symptomatic things in your body, right? You'll feel it as, at the most benign level, you'll feel it as reflux, gastritis, gastroparesis. So gastritis is a bloating in the stomach. Gastroparesis is that inability to empty the stomach. So when you eat food, you feel full for a really long time, that heaviness. You know, those are the most benign things, right? But then it goes all the way to the most severe things, which are cancers. You know, H. pylori is a class 1 carcinogen by the WHO because it drives gastric cancers. It drives gastroesophageal cancers. Now there's even, but certain types of H. pylori, that's another thing. There's hundreds of different serotypes of H. pylori, right? Some of them are cancer inducing, some of them are not, just like HPV. Some of them are, some of them aren't cancer inducing. So what happens with H. pylori is it, you know, it's not acid resilient to the point of the normal stomach acid, normal physiological stomach acid levels, which under a healthy condition, your stomach acid should be like a pH of 1.3, 1.5, right? It's really, really, really acidic. Mm-hmm. H. pylori doesn't like those levels. It doesn't do well in those levels. So what it does is it produces an enzyme called urease. Urease hydrolyzes hydrochloric acid and then forms ammonia out of it, right? Wow. And that's how it buffers the stomach, the acid around itself. So if you have enough H. pylori throughout the lining of your stomach, you're buffering HCl all over the stomach and you're dramatically increasing the pH of the stomach, making it more basic rather than acidic, right? So H. pylori likes the condition of being less acidic. And so, you know, that in itself, if you think about it, you go, okay, if we take a pill to reduce the acidity of the stomach, that's probably a good thing for the H. pylori, right? Or it can do it all by itself as well. And it does so in at least 50% of adults.
So this is interesting. Okay. So we don't know if it's native to the lining of the stomach. We don't know that, but can't we know that? Like, don't we know if it has a job in there? Haven't we done enough research to know that H. pylori is doing something in the lining of the stomach? And there must be people that don't have it at all if it's not native.
So there are people that don't have any detectable levels of H. pylori at all. You know, and it seems to vary a little bit from population to population. There's a difference, for example, between North American populations and Southeast Asian populations in terms of the types of H. pylori, the levels that are predominant in people, and what the outcomes are, right? Where in those cases, in the Southeast Asian cases, it's really high risk for gastroesophageal cancers and things like that. There is some indication that H. pylori, like other gram-negative bacteria, because it's also gram-negative bacteria. And what I mean by gram-negative bacteria, for people that don't know, it's a type of bacteria that has a endotoxin that in its cell membrane, right? And somewhere around 50% of all the microbes in your gut and so on are all gram-negative. So you make a lot of this endotoxin. Gram-negative bacteria at really low levels are good for upregulating the immune response because the immune system is always training itself against gram-negative bacteria, okay, right? Because when you undergo sepsis, for example, right, which we know is a very scary thing, and the immune system in the body is constantly trying to protect you from sepsis. The reason for that is if you think about the gut lining, the thing that truly separates the inside and the outside of the body, right, which is not whether something enters into your mouth, because even if you swallow something, it's still technically outside your body. And the reason for that is the digestive tract is a tube that's open on both ends, right? So it can just pass through, if you will. For it to truly be inside your body, it has to go past the intestinal lining or the stomach lining and end up in circulation, right? And the barrier that prevents things from entering into the intestinal lining or the stomach lining is a mucosal layer, so a layer of mucus, and then a single cell thick barrier called the epithelium, right? So above that are 40 trillion or so bacteria, half of which are gram negative, which can cause sepsis like that.
Wow.
So your body is very conscious of this massive amount of microbes that sit just a few millimeters above the one measly cell thick barrier that protects them from flooding into your bloodstream any single moment of every single day, right?
Jeez.
And so sepsis, we all know, is a very scary thing. You could go from walking around being fine to death's doorstep in 24 hours, right? Mm. And so your body's constantly protecting against sepsis. So your immune system trains constantly to detect gram-negative bacteria and their endotoxin, in particular, the endotoxin's called LPS. And so in your stomach, where H. pylori sits, if you have it, it's releasing LPS, and your immune system's constantly training on the other side of the stomach lining to defend against it and upregulate antibodies and turn on T cells and B cells and dendritic cells and all that. So it's good training for the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment it goes above a certain level, then there's diminishing return on that training.
Right. Geez. Okay. The SIBO, you said there was, you mentioned three reasons
Yes.
I didn't hear you mention the potential for, increased usage of low grade, poor quality probiotics and how that became such a huge in the last 10, 15 years, the usage of those just, you know, went, it was skyrocketed, just became a household thing to take probiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my question in the past was, could that be contributing to SIBO? Because these bacteria aren't getting very far in the body because they're just like low quality or for whatever reason. Is mm-hmm. that still something that we think, or is that not really driving SIBO?
Yeah, I would say that that's always a concern. And the reason is because if you take these, what I call kitchen sink formulas, right, that have like 15, 20 strains in them, they've got 50, 100, 200 billion CFUs in them. But the problem is most of those strains don't have any studies on them. You have no idea what they're doing in the body. You have no idea whether or not the body sees them as foreign or sees them as commensal, right? So does the immune system, when it sees this huge rush of 100 billion strains coming through, if it's going to attack all of those or not, right? So is it causing inflammation in the lining of the gut? And if it is causing inflammation in the lining of the gut, in the small bowel in particular, where they're all released when you take the capsules, then you're going to drive an increased risk of leakiness in the gut, and leakiness in the gut will lead to constipation. Constipation will lead to bowel stasis, so the bowel doesn't move, and that gives you a much higher risk of SIBO. Right. Mm. One of the first things that occurs in many people with SIBO is that bowel stasis. The bowel stops moving the way it's supposed to. You mentioned constipation as a very common thing in your group.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of the underlying driver of SIBO. Now, here's one of the reasons why constipation occurs. When your gut becomes leaky and you get all this gram-negative endotoxin leaking through, the gram-negative endotoxin makes its way up the enteric nervous system, which is a neurological system that covers your whole digestive tract, moves up the vagus nerve, which is the nerve that connects the brain and the gut neurological systems. And then basically this at the brain stem, there's an area called the dorsal vagal complex. It lodges itself in the dorsal vagal complex. It creates an inflammatory response. And then that shuts off the signals from the brain to the gut. So the brain is telling the gut to move. It's sending the peristaltic signals, but the gut is not moving because it's not getting the messages. So now you're undergoing stasis of the bowel and constipation. One of the ways in which your body protects against SIBO developing is to not allow food to sit in the small intestine for very long, right? Mm. And for people to understand that, keep in mind that bacteria have this lag phase and then log phase of growth, right? If you take a fresh food and you sit it out on the counter, it doesn't spoil immediately. It doesn't spoil within the first 2, 3, 4, 6 hours even, right? But if you left it there for 48 hours, you come back, you'll start to see it putrefy and ferment. The reason it takes that much time is because the bacteria have to go out of the lag phase where it's not really multiplying very much. It's kind of sensing its environment. It's trying to figure out which genes to turn on and all that. And then all of a sudden it goes into log phase growth if the environment's right, and it starts exponentially growing. That period takes 7, 8 hours before bacteria can come out of the lag phase and go into log phase. Mm-hmm. But the way your system is designed is to clear food from your small intestine within that time, right? So that there is no food there for the microbes to go into log phase growth and start fermenting and overgrowing like crazy. That's another very important protective mechanism. So if your bowel becomes stalled and you don't have good peristalsis, you're not moving the food through in adequate amounts, then the food sits there long enough to start to get fermented by the microbes, right? And so that constipation comes from leakiness in the gut. Leakiness in the gut comes from inflammation that occurs in the lining of the gut through numerous stimuli. And non-characterized probiotics could be a source of that. There was a couple studies out of the Israeli Academy that showed that when you use these kind of kitchen sink non-specific probiotics, it actually competes with and slows down the regrowth of your own endogenous bacteria after a course of antibiotics, right? Mm. Which means that they're acting in an egregious way rather than a beneficial way. And we also know, from our studies, for example, on the peptidoglycan strain, the ZenBiome strain that I talked about, that when you combine that strain with other bifidobacteria, it actually negates the effect.
Wow.
Which was really telling, right? So the assumption in the industry is, let's just mix as many probiotic strains as we can. Great. Yeah. Let's deliver them all, 100 billion, 200 billion, 25 strains, with no clue as to how these strains interact with each other. Mm-hmm. Right. And we saw very clearly, we have this beautiful, powerful gut-brain strain that can dramatically reduce cortisol, bring down anxiety, improve sleep, all of these things. You add another bifido that's not an exopolysaccharide, not a peptidoglycan strain, and it completely shunts the effect of the good strain.
That must have been a pretty exciting discovery for you guys, because this could be the answer, right? For all of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then one of my earlier questions, and you might've answered this, was basically like, was SIBO always a thing, or is it just misdiagnosed in the past?
No, I think like many other GI conditions, SIBO is definitely increasing in prevalence. Mm. And I think it's because of a number of factors. Number one is because our livers are getting compromised earlier and early on in life, right? We're eating crappy food. So if you imagine you eat all these processed foods, your liver has to process all the artificial colors and preservatives. And, you know, each individual is exposed to somewhere around 80,000 chemicals a day nowadays, right? Than we were few decades ago. So your liver has to process all of that, which means that the liver is undergoing a tremendous amount of stress. And so we're seeing a higher and higher number of cases of non-alcoholic liver disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, or even just early stages liver dysfunction like fibrosis and liver enzyme dysfunction, right? It used to be that the vast majority of people that went into cirrhosis of the liver did so because of alcohol or hepatitis, right? Those are the two big drivers. Now, non-alcoholic fatty liver cirrhosis and non-hepatitis fatty liver cirrhosis is a predominant version, right? And so I think people's livers are getting compromised, which I explained earlier. If your liver gets compromised, your bile acid pool gets compromised. That makes you much more susceptible to SIBO. People are also using PPIs. Remember that PPIs went off prescription and now they're OTC. Anyone can walk into the drugstore and buy it without a doctor's consent, right?
Yeah.
People are using these PPIs or using antacids a lot more because this whole idea of neutralizing stomach acid became like a solution to deal with your GI symptoms, right? Mm-hmm. So that is another issue. And I think the significant use of things like antibiotics and all that drive further dysbiosis.
All medications, I would imagine, right? That kind of tax the liver, because we're like, especially in America, we're just we spend so much money on prescription meds, the highest country that does that. So I'm sure. Okay. So then there's some other questions here in regards to, the carrot salad. I don't know if you know about Dr. Ray Peet's carrot salad, but it's really popular. And we've been doing it in the group for a while, but just recently had this challenge with it where it was like, you shred the carrot. It has to be shredded. You put coconut oil, apple cider vinegar, or just vinegar, and maybe some olive oil for taste and maybe some salt. And you eat that on an empty stomach once a day. And it does incredible things for helping to eliminate estrogen and endotoxin. Now, I love it. It really does make a huge difference in my body and everything. I can feel the changes. A lot of women are loving it, but some women get bloated and have issues with it. And it's shocking actually how different our bodies can be. And I wondered if you knew what was going on with that particular fiber in some women.
Yeah. So, you know, fiber, what I call in the world of microbiome research, you talk about carbohydrate utilization, right? How does your microbiome utilize carbohydrates? In some cases, people have really healthy microbiomes. They have a lot of what we call saccharolytic fermentation. Saccharolytic fermentation are the types of microbes in your gut that can take fibers coming in like you get from the carrot fiber, and then convert that to things like butyrate, propionate, acetate, and other really important short-chain fatty acids that have a calming effect on the gut, an anti-inflammatory effect on the gut, a healing effect on the lining of the gut, right? But if you don't have the right microbes, you have high levels of proteolytic fermentation, which works against the saccharolytic. Then what you're going to do is create more toxins like P. cresol and ammonia and so on, instead of the short chain fatty acid. So the same substrate, but your microbiome treats it differently, right? And so that is the key difference between whether or not something like a carrot salad will be beneficial to you or will actually make you feel worse.
Yeah.
The other thing with the carrots that's great is, you know, carrots tend to be high in beta carotene and other carotenoids, which is good because carotenoids are really important for reducing inflammatory stress on the lining of the gut. Right. This is why we have a strain, which you've probably seen in the Just Thrive with the Megaspore product called HU36, right? Which is a Bacillus indicus. That's a very powerful strain, and a key part of how these probiotics stop leaky gut is because it produces very high levels of carotenoids in the lining of the gut. It produces alpha carotene, beta carotene, lutein, lycopene, astaxanthin, zeaxanthin, and so on. And all of that reduces oxidative stress and inflammatory damage in the lining of the gut. And it brings down the oxidative damage, which is really important for kind of calming the gut down and allowing it to repair and heal.
Wow.
Right. So I would say that. And I would say for maybe some of those women that don't respond well to the carrot salad, maybe not use the coconut oil with it, because that could be exasperating as well. So coconut oil is a strong antimicrobial, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also very high in saturated fat. And the long chain fatty acids in coconut oil will kill lots of bacteria. And so for a lot of people, that can create more endotoxemia, more leakiness in the gut, right? And so if they're getting a negative response to it, maybe do it without the coconut oil, maybe higher amounts of olive oil, and maybe take a fish oil with it on top of it just to impact the beneficial fatty acids in there.
Oh, wow. Okay. You just cracked open another level of stuff. Okay. Let me see if I could do this quickly. So the beta carotenes, the carotenes, the carotenoids don't need to be converted, because I know that when you eat like a sweet potato and you're trying to access the, you know, that vitamin A, in order to utilize it, it needs to be converted at the liver to vitamin A retinol, but you can't use that carotenoid. You can't use that beta carotene unless you have that capacity to convert that. Is that the same thing with these carotenoids in the gut too? Or can the body use that whole carotenoid to heal the gut?
Yeah. So I think what we have to do is separate what we're talking about, who's using it, right?
Okay.
If it's our cells who are using it, we need to convert it. So if our cells need to use, whether it's beta carotene or alpha carotene or vitamin E, our liver has to conjugate it in a way that our cells can utilize it. When it's the microbes in the gut, they can utilize it exactly how it is.
Wow.
So it actually favors the microbes being able to utilize it if you're just consuming it that way.
Okay. And then you said fish oil. It was your fault, not mine. So PUFA, how do you feel about this polyunsaturated fat business that's really, really, really good? And I'm very much a proponent of avoiding seed oils completely. Now, I know that some cod liver oil is more beneficial and definitely has a nice balance and can be a little better, but I never had good results with it. And so I don't use it. How do you feel about this polyunsaturated fat, this PUFA that's actually actually wreaking havoc in our skin cells, playing a role with estrogen dominance, playing a role with melasma, aging, lipofuscin, la la la.
Yeah, so it largely depends on whether or not it's an omega-6 or omega-3, right? So that to me is the key component to it. So if you have high omega-6s in your polyunsaturated and you don't have the right microbes to convert omega-6 into omega-3, then it can cause more problems in your system because you don't tolerate or utilize it well, right? So all of these fatty acids, so whether it's an omega-6, omega-3, if it's a saturated fat, for us to be able to use it, we have to be able to resolve those fats into much, much smaller intermediates, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what we don't remember that. And so a lot of that resolving will occur in the gut first. The microbes will metabolize the fatty acids to a certain degree. And then your cells have to be able to resolve them into these smaller and smaller intermediates. Certain people don't have the capacity to do that. So then the fats can actually become problematic for them, right? Mm-hmm. What I like about fish oil, I particularly like high EPA fish oil. And the reason I like high EPA fish oil is because when you look at EPA and DHA, both of them as omega-3 fatty acids, EPA stays in the gut and gets metabolized and used in the gut predominantly. So there are all of these studies showing that high levels of EPA are very anti-inflammatory in the gut. And there's, in fact, a very, very good laboratory measure of a number of chronic risks. It's called the AA-EPA ratio. That is the arachidonic acid to EPA ratio. Arachidonic acid is a precursor of a bunch of inflammatory cascades in your body, including a pain signal. So not that people need to know this, but arachidonic acid gets metabolized into something called cyclooxygenase or lipoxygenase, right? Lipoxygenase creates inflammation in the body. Cyclooxygenase creates pain in the body. Mm. So a lot of the anti-pain analgesics and all block COX. That's why they're called
COX.
Yeah, COX inhibition, right? COX mm-hmm. inhibitors. They block pain by inhibiting cyclooxygenase, or LOX inhibitors block inflammation by blocking lipoxygenase. So the amount of arachidonic acid that you have will determine how much pain and inflammation your system goes through. Now, EPA counteracts arachidonic acid. It interferes with arachidonic acid being resolved into these pain and inflammation inducing compounds. So if you have high levels of EPA and low levels of arachidonic acid, it's a much healthier state to be in. And lots of studies show that high levels of EPA against arachidonic acid means much lower incidence of stroke, heart disease, Alzheimer's, all kinds of long-term problems, because mm-hmm. it overall reduces inflammation. So when I say fish oil, I mean a high EPA fish oil. And when we, for example, when we made a high EPA fish oil, we also focused on two other things. One was DPA. DPA allows the EPA to get absorbed effectively. And then the third thing was PRMs, or pre-resolving mediators. So remember I mentioned that even EPA and DHA, the omega-3 fatty acids, have to be resolved into smaller and smaller fatty acids before they can be used by the cell. Mm-hmm. The pre-resolving mediators are already those pre-resolved versions of EPA and DHA. So they are much more effective at stoking an anti-inflammatory response in the immediately after you take it, right? Mm. So having high levels of those basically catalyzes the metabolic response that you need to convert that EPA and DHA into these anti-inflammatory compounds. So it's not just any fish oil. It's very specific, the type of fish oil that is beneficial for the gut. I do think that PUFAs can be overused. It's another one of those things that, you know, it's like, hey, it's good for you, so everyone take a ton of it. You know, mm-hmm. same thing. Like coconut oil is the same thing. You know, you can absolutely overuse coconut oil as well, mm-hmm. right? Because it's just, everyone said it's a health trend and everyone's using it nonstop. So yeah, I mean, I agree that those things need to be taken in balance for sure.
Okay. And then just this, have you heard of using zinc carnosine for leaky gut?
Yeah. I mean, you know, zinc. So, okay. Zinc carnosine, it's the same as using L-glutamine for leaky gut, okay. right? It's a component of a mechanism that could help with sealing up the lining of the gut. But whether or not that mechanism is in play is completely dependent on the microbes that are in the gut. Right? The microbes control whether or not your gut is leaky. Right. And that's the thing that people just have to understand, because
right.
throwing things like L-glutamine at it, at zinc carnosine, even magnesiums and things like that, if the microbes are still dysfunctional and are driving intestinal permeability, you'll never fix it with throwing those things, right?
Okay.
Those are small little tools in the process of fixing the gut microbiome and the leakiness in the gut. The analogy I give to people is, if you have a broken car in your driveway, something's wrong with it, right? You could throw a bag of tools at it. The car is not going to fix itself.
Right.
Right? You need an intelligent mechanic to go in there and use the tools to fix it. So in this case, the intelligent mechanic are the changes in microbes that you need. You need to bring back microbes that seal up the lining of the gut. And then they will use things like glutamine. They can use things like zinc carnosine to fix the gut.
Gotcha.
Now, you probably get enough zinc and enough glutamate and so on in your diet to be able to fix the gut. What you really need to fix are the microbes and the microbial population.
It comes back to that. And that's what we've always, always said. So my last question is, what about histamine? Does histamine and microbes, can you talk about that?
Yeah, a few different things. So one, there are lots of microbes that produce histamine, right? So just in their normal byproduct of their fermentation, they'll produce histamine. So that can be a problem for some people who are histamine intolerant. But for others, it's perfectly fine because they can metabolize the histamine as well. And it doesn't trigger an inflammatory response or an immune response in the body. We'll talk about why that is. So, and then the second part of it is microbes in your gut will produce histamine in response to the presence of infection, because that's one of the ways that your microbiome is trying to alert your immune system that there's a problematic organism in the gut. It produces histamine and indole. Those are two compounds that the microbiome produces to try to signal to your immune system that there's a big problem there. So you could have histamine intolerance in a few different ways. One is, you're taking microbes or you through fermentation or other sources, probiotics and so on, that are producing high amounts of histamine, and you have an unusual level of mast cell activation, right? And that histamine is triggering even more mast cell activation and more eosinophil activation, so you're getting this hypersensitivity response. And you also have an imbalance of microbes that are supposed to metabolize the histamine, so it doesn't overexpress in your system. So that's one way. But to me, that's probably it's probably a secondary component to having mast cell activation in the first place. Right. And I'll mention quickly how you get mast cell activation.
Yeah.
The second part of it is having latent infections. So you could have, long term, viral infections, for example, in your gut that just persist. Right. We know there's certain viruses like herpes simplex and papilloma and Epstein-Barr that can live in your body forever. And they constantly, and your microbiome is constantly seeing these viruses and trying to get your immune system to pay attention so that it's constantly kicking off histamine. Histamine is a way for your microbiome to signal to your immune system to attack something, right? But it's attracting the wrong part of your immune system. It's because it's histamine response or indole, it's attracting innate immune reactors like mast cells, like basophils, like eosinophils, that create a hypersensitivity response, right? But here's the underlying important thing about all of that, is that mast cells are these sentinel cells that are really trying to, again, protect you from sepsis, right? So they hang out in that layer below the intestinal epithelium. That means if something moved through that one single cell line thick layer of your gut, it's now entering into blood circulation. That area is called the basolateral circulation. That's where the mast cells hang out. They're constantly hanging out there to see, are there going to be gaps in the cells? That way we can plug that gap and attack everything that comes through, right? Mm. And one of the ways in which they measure whether or not there are gaps, there are receptors on the underside of the cells that signal to it any changes in the tight junction proteins. The tight junction proteins are the proteins in between the intestinal cells that allow the cells to open and cinch back up, right? Sometimes it needs to open for nutrition to go through, and then it has to close back up. If these proteins become dismantled, it sends a signal to the bottom of the cell that the mast cell can pick up, and the mast cell goes, hey, this is a vulnerable place. I need to sit here, right? And so the mast cell is sitting there, activated, ready to go, and then anything that comes through, like a piece of food or, a bacterial component, it starts firing off all its activation, right? It's attracting basophils and eosinophils, it's sending off histamine, it's sending off all kinds of chemicals that activate and irritate the system. At the same time, what's supposed to happen is T regulatory cells, these are the regulators of the immune system, are supposed to come by and monitor this whole thing and then basically shut down any unfavorable immune responses. And the T cells are supposed to say, hey, you don't need to attack this stuff, shut it down, mast cell, right? And then try to induce a repair in that area. The proliferation of T cells is also dependent on a healthy, diverse microbiome. Mm-hmm. So if your healthy, diverse microbiome doesn't exist, and that has led to the leaky gut, and that has also led to the mast cell being activated and hypersensitive, you likely don't have the T regulatory cells either, right? Because the thing that manages whether or not your gut is leaky is also the thing that manages whether or not your T cells are functioning, your regulatory T cells. So now you have undue activation because your gut is leaky and the regulators of that response aren't present. So now you have this constant growing of this unnecessary inflammatory response, right?
Wow.
So those kind of people, you have histamine and all, that's a problem. So it goes back to fixing that dysbiosis, the microbes, the diversity, the keystone species, sealing up the lining of the gut, and all of that stuff starts to fall into place.
Amazing. Amazing. I mean, that's so the mechanics, the way that the body works in the gut. I mean, all throughout, it's just unbelievable, really. Tell me about that product one more time. Is it the Calm or Jute?
The Jute is called Just Calm, which is available to everyone. And that's mm-hmm. a 1714 strain.
Okay.
That's the psychobiotic strain with the peptidoglycan, right? So that's a key one for managing the stress, the mood, and improving the sleep outcomes as well. And then for the leakiness and the diversity issues and the keystone species issues, all the other things we talked about, it's really about the probiotic, the Just Thrive, the probiotic and antioxidant. The antioxidant mm-hmm. comes from that strain that produces high levels of carotenoids. And then you need the prebiotic. There's a prebiotic with high levels of oligosaccharides. That is really important for sealing up the gut. And then there's another product called Gut Fortify, which has key amino acids that are the building blocks of the mucus layer, and then a polyphenol mix, which mm-hmm. is really, really important as well. The polyphenols increase the growth of acromantia and other beneficial organisms that seal up the lining of the gut and modulate the immune response in the lining of the gut. So, you know, what we have to do as we're thinking about hormone balancing and we're utilizing exogenous hormones and so on, we have to go really specific into the gut and get really, really good at working on diversity, sealing up the lining of the gut, increasing keystone species, combating Helicobacter pylori, if that's the case. I'll tell you how you do that. And then also managing the mood response, right? The stress-induced leakiness in the gut. Now, here's how you do the Helicobacter pylori. Under the Just Thrive brand, we don't have that strain yet. But under the Microbiome Labs brand, we do. It's a product called PyloGuard. PyloGuard is a lactobacillus reuteri that binds Helicobacter pylori in the stomach and takes it out of the system.
Wow.
It's not even a live bacteria. It's actually intact, but it's dead. So it's called a postbiotic. And it has a very high affinity for Helicobacter pylori. So yeah, it gets in the gut, it gets in the stomach, really, and also in the throat. It's in a capsule, and we ask you to pull the capsule open and mix it in water and drink it. So you coat it in your mouth, in your throat, and in your stomach. It binds it and takes it out. There are 9 published studies on it, over 1,000 patients, and it's extremely effective at bringing down the level of H. pylori.
So the mastic gum, the aloe gel, aloe vera, all those things, just not as nearly as effective as this.
Yeah, because those are all kind of secondary things. You hope it gets in. It may bind other things, like mastic gum could bind other things in the system. If Helicobacter pylori is deep in the gastric mucosa, the mastic gum will never get to it, right?
Okay.
Aloe is really about, reducing inflammation and so on. So what we are doing is we're really going after very specific tools, microbial tools that will get the job done, right?
Yeah.
And we've done the H. pylori studies against the most egregious versions, which is the pharmaceutical approach to take to treating H. pylori, and it stands up head to head with all the possible side effects, right?
Yeah. So if someone incorporated this protocol over time, like really, really diligently committed to that and also got rid of the glutens and all did all the right things, how long, and I know it's hard to say, but how long would you say it would take to remediate a gut like that?
So the beauty of the gut is you're changing the ecosystem. And when you change the ecosystem, you can absolutely see real profound changes in a relatively short amount of time. I would say in 3 months, you should see some very significant positive changes.
Wow.
6 months, you know, you should be able to start adding in foods that you weren't able to eat before because you were too sensitive to them. Within a year, you should feel like a completely different person, right? Mm-hmm. And I would add in, so I would at least 50% of people. So anyone that's experienced any sort of reflux or bloating in the stomach or you know, the gastritis or gastroparesis, I would definitely look at doing the H. pylori one as well. So add in the H. pylori, do the Just Calm to improve the gut-brain connection and reduce that aspect of inflammation and leakiness in the gut, right? Mm-hmm. And the prebiotic, the probiotic, and then the gut fortify for the gut lining and the microbiota. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing is you should absolutely support the liver as well, right? Everyone that's in their 40s, 50s, and beyond has a liver that's undergone probably far more than the liver is designed to do, mm-hmm. right? Our livers haven't adapted yet to the level of toxicity that we're putting onto the liver, right? Because of the chemicals and the lifestyle that we lead. And so I would use some very, very good liver support on an ongoing basis. Things like, you know, psilocybin.
Oh,
that could work too. But milk thistle, for example, right? Which could be really powerful.
What about just B complex?
B complex, milk thistle will really help detoxify and reduce the toxins on the liver. Okay. So you want to, you know, just find a liver support that you feel really good about and agrees with you well. Because that's going to be a really key part, because the liver is kind of the linchpin of this whole system working. Mm-hmm. Right? If that starts to go down, then it becomes, you know,
yeah,
you're really going down. Because then it's hard to recover the liver, right? So the gut you can recover. The liver, once it starts going under fibrosis and starts becoming cirrhotic, then it's really hard to recover it, right?
But it can be recovered.
It can be helped, right? But you mm-hmm. can't bring it back to your 30-year-old liver.
Of course, your gut,
you can bring it back to your 30-year-old gut.
Wow.
You could be 70 and you could bring it back to a 30-year-old gut, because in the gut, it's all controlled by microbes. So if we change the microbes, the rest of the gut will follow through.
What about people who, like, I have this a genetic predisposition to have low diversity in my microbiome? I mean, I know these genetic tests can be, you know, whatever, but like, can I increase my diversity? What if someone just doesn't have a diverse microbiome?
You can. Yeah, you absolutely can. And the reason is, so the reason you would have a genetic predisposition for it is that whole secretory, non-secretory status, right?
Oh. So
secretor status just means that you don't secrete enough mucolytic type of compounds into your microbiome. So you feed your microbiome not the same rate that others do, which means that your microbiome probably needs more auxiliary fibers and things like that.
Okay.
So you could absolutely do it. You can absolutely bring back your microbiome, maintain healthy diversity. And keep in mind, no species are ever completely lost from your microbiome, right? They can be so low that they're basically non-functional, right? They're like hanging on with like 3 cells for the last 10 years going, man, I can't wait for us to be able to come back, right? They're just hanging on, right? And microbes can do that. They can do that indefinitely. So they're just waiting for the right condition to proliferate again. And that's really the key, is about giving them the right condition.
Well, that's good news. I thought once they, you know, like they're gone, especially if you're in antibiotics for a long time and they just like decimated your microbiome. But that's really good news. Well, you always blow my mind. You've been so generous with your time. And one of the things that really, and I talk about it all the time, but you just really drove it home, was I always talk about dental infection and how it's something. And then after this COVID business, how they were saying that a lot of people who went from bad to worse and ended up on, you know, respirators and everything, that they actually had a really high amount of Provotella and other bacteria that really took it into their lungs and just like killed them. Yep. And the fact that you were saying, you know, that it can get past that stomach acid, that first line of defense we have through our stomach acid, and then get into the small intestine. And now you're having it also break into that leaky barrier and go, I mean, that leaky gut and get into the bloodstream. No wonder it's like such a big deal. I'm so glad you said that.
It is. So oral microbiome is a huge driver of disease in the body. And so, yeah, that's something people have to pay attention to as well.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. Next time we won't wait two and a half, three years. But
I can't believe it's been that long.
I know it's crazy.
Time really does fly. But thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure, and I love being able to, you know, connect the dots for people and help hopefully make sense for them on things. And you know, everyone's just trying to do their best, right? We can only do as well as the information we have on hand. So part of my mission is giving people more information so they can do better.
Heroic. Thank you so much, Kiran.
Thank you, Kitty.
So incredible. And I really had to process a lot of what he said and just digest it, because some of it was, I was pushing up against, you know. I'll tell you a few of those things. One of them was the coconut oil, right? Because a lot of us are consuming a lot of coconut oil, and it makes a lot of sense that it could be causing problems also, because it's all about balance, isn't it? You know, you too much of a good thing can cause problems. And that's basically what he was saying. And that for me was the takeaway, is like in regards to supplementing progesterone or any hormone, really. You know, you can do it. It certainly can be so beneficial for so many. I mean, it literally, guys, saved my life and so many women that are in the estrogen dominant support group. But, you know, you have to address the whole picture, and the whole picture begins with the gut. And it's never ending, right? I can't tell you how many times I have clients or people in the group that say, when they say, I'm so confused because of this or this. And I say, well, have you, you know, focused on your gut? And they say, oh yeah, I did that. I have years. I did it for 4 years, or that's all I ever do. And you know, we don't ever stop. And he alluded to that, you know, it's a journey. It's an ongoing journey. It's not a destination. You're never going to get to the top of Mount Gut Health and be like, I won. You know, you're always going to be working at it. And that has been my history. You know, now I have 17 years of working on my gut. And it's like, does it ever end? It doesn't. And one of the things that I noticed, and this was one of those moments in the interview where I heard it and then I didn't fully process it until I edited the podcast. And I was like, oh my goodness. He said, you know, when for some reason we start dumping estrogen, or he said for many reasons you might start dumping estrogen into the gut. One of those reasons could be because you start taking progesterone and it can sort of create a detox effect, right? But another thing is when you're going into menopause, and a lot of us are, your blood progesterone levels, serum levels, and estrogen levels, your progesterone's going to crash and your estrogen is going to dominate, but it's not going to stay in circulation in your blood. It's going to kind of retreat into tissues. It's going to go into the tissues. And this goes the same for when you detoxify and conjugate estrogens out of the liver and they get dumped into the bowel. That's a dumping of estrogen that's, you know, going to go into the tissues if you're not detoxifying that estrogen properly. And so menopause in and of itself is going to create big changes in the gut. And that just hit me like a ton of bricks, because, you know, it's frustrating because you think, gosh, I've done all this work. Why do all of a sudden I have these new gut health issues? And you just want to scream. But it's because it's ever changing. It's like the universe. It's like the stars, you know, it's constantly changing and evolving and morphing and doing all these things. And so we have to be ready to kind of ride those waves. We can't just say, okay, that's it. I did it. I graduated in gut health. What's next? You know, it just doesn't work that way.
So that also reminds me of we are getting very close to launching the Healthy Gut Girls Mighty Network, which I'm so excited about. It's just going to be this beautiful, comprehensive community of guidance, gut health, hormones, friendship, all of us just hanging out together. It's free to get into the community is totally free. There's all kinds of resources there. And then there's going to be different levels depending on where you are in your healing journey as far as information that you can have access to. And it's just a lot more organized and comprehensive than Facebook. It really is just like a little online university community. It's so exciting. And we really focus a lot on gut health in there, from the very, very, very basics of gut health to quite complex information as well. And I'm just super excited. So I hope you guys join us. I'm going to be posting those links and everything so people can come on board with us when it's time. And then just remember the information he gave us, Kieran gave us about the way to start healing the leaky gut and building the diversity in the microbiome. That those products that he mentioned is actually in a little bundle in the show notes, and you can use my coupon code, which is HGG20, and you can get 20% off. And I'm going to start after Lent because, would you believe, for Lent, I gave up all supplements. I gave up just taking any supplements at all. Mostly give my liver a break and just reset and see exactly what types of things that I'm really in need of, like the things I've noticed. And I'm going to do a whole special on what I learned during this Lenten season to let you know. You might learn something from it. I know I'm certainly learning a lot from it, but what I am just creating what I'm my new protocol is going to be. And I'm definitely going to include the Just Calm, which was the product that has that particular bacteria in it that helps to alleviate the cortisol damage in the gut. That, and then back on the spore-based probiotics. And and then I'll tell you what my new protocol is going to be when I'm sure of what I'm going to do. Anyway, friends, thank you so much for joining Kieran and I, and have a great day.
Yeah.